You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, February 23rd, 2015. My name is Matt Binder.
I'm Michael Brooks.
And this is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting to you live, steps from the industrial-ravaged Gowanus Canal.
In the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Jeet here, writing for the New Republic on how to make it in conservative America if you aren't white. It's going to be a really interesting conversation. Also, Rudy Giuliani, we're going to give you the definitive guide. How terrible this guy is. Malcolm X, anniversary of his assassination was 50 years ago over this past weekend. We're going to talk a little bit about his legacy, and also we have on tap today.
We will have a complete rundown of the conservative crybaby whining about last night's Oscars.
Oh, I can...
It is fantastic.
It's the best part of the Oscars.
Oh, easily. Hands down. I can assure you that 100%.
I'm totally serious. I was stuck at airports and not able to watch the Oscars. But as soon as I saw just in the headlines that American Sniper didn't clean up, I knew that there was going to be just a rage, just a primal howl from the right wingosphere. So, Matt, that's your beat, man.
Oh, it's going to be fun.
It's going to be fun.
And it's going to be tons of fun.
And obviously, we also would love you to join us in the fun half, members, with your calls, your IMs, your opinions, your contributions, and of course, if you wanted to debate us, we are ready for that. Anything else we should mention up top?
We've been gone for about a week, small, short vacation. Sam was in LA filming Marin.
Filming with Marin.
Yep. He will be on Marin on IFC. Finally.
Finally. About
third
time.
Season in.
I've been able to end my boycott of Marin now that that happened. So
yes.
I was able, during my travels over vacation, I listened to a couple of episodes of Marin's podcast.
Ah.
And it's good.
So,
it's good.
Yeah. So that's one thing that happened during vacation.
Do you notice, I just have to say, that Obama impression is so dangerous that I've done it so much that it really does.
It comes through sometimes.
I just talk like him now. It's good.
It's good.
Mark Marin's good podcast. Yep.
Yeah, but
very emotionally revealing.
We have tons of news to catch up with you on, and it's just not possible we could do it all in one day, but we're going to try to give you as much as we possibly can.
We're going to try to give you as much as we possibly can. Obviously, become a member, but we will talk more about that before we go into the fun half. We will be right back with Jeet here of the New Republic.
I beg your pack up and bar. Me said that movement alive. Marcus if we organize and centralize. Rasta fit when banks and enterprise. So me not stop chanting my soul enter Zion. Princes of fire. Babylon me tell you your time just expire. What kind of wickedness me a your transpire? And no gasoline and a tire. Eternal fire. Dirty Babylon you want to get bruised. I said they just can't win, you're going to lose. So we are want them. Ooh, yeah. I beg your papa, one, me, I tell you.
make me show them say salt fish no come from Anya. That fish they come a far way. They bring him all the way from Norway. Hey, I could the rasta them a try for chicken that can't be me national dish a eternal fire. And dirty Babylon you walk again bruised. Me a burn them, want them fire. I said they just can't win, you're going to lose. Can they kill upon them? I beg you back up and go. Me I tell you, quick, back up and go. Tell me why. Every time I hear about Africa, I shackles and chains. Tell me why. You try to corrupt the little Rastaman brain. And if you tell the youth them to Africa exists long before the middle passes. Me come to tell you get to use them for white because Babylon a brainwash the masses a fire. Not the Babylon you will go get bruised. We a burn them fire. I said they just can't win, you're going to lose. We a burn them. I tell you back up and burn. Me a beg you move. I said we fuck up and go.
Still straight.
All right. We are back on the Majority Report. My name is Matt Binder.
I'm Michael Brooks. Joining us now is Ajit here. He's a Canadian journalist joining us from Canada. Ajit, how are you?
Very good. Good afternoon. Good to be here.
So happy to have you. So you have a recent piece in the New Republic, which is one of the only things that I read over my vacation, and it was a very, very good piece called "How to Make It in Conservative America If You Aren't White." There's a lot to this, and it brings us to some figures like Dinesh D'Souza, who we'll get to soon, who, you know, even within the context of this show that we do, where we definitely sort of part of what we do is monitor conservative media, even in that context, everybody's sort of like, hey, look, Dinesh, you know, he's just this sort of racist clown. Why give him oxygen? And I think there's a lot of truth to that. But what your piece puts him in context and puts a much broader conversation in context. So by way of setting it up, just like you did in your article, how does your family background help you understand this relationship between the conservative movement and non-white people within the conservative movement?
Sure. Yeah, I was born in India, in the north of India, in the province of Punjab. And like all my family, at least my blood relations are there, although I have other family members now who are like from Sri Lanka and Bulgaria, but so my background was growing up as an Indian immigrant in Canada. And, one thing I sort of like noticed growing up, was like there was kind of like a spectrum of attitudes among, Indian immigrants, towards, racial issues, and particularly towards like sort of like, you know, Afro-Canadians. And, you know, like, I mean, I want to emphasize there is a spectrum. Like there's like, people, you know, I grew up with, family members who are like very, you know, strongly anti-racist and sort of identify themselves as being, you know, non-white and as part of a larger coalition needed to challenge racism. But there's also like Indians, immigrants that I sort of knew who took a kind of opposite tack where like, for them, making it in Canada meant like differentiating themselves from groups that they considered like less successful, which includes, both of black Canadians, but also actually in the Canadian context, Native Canadians, right? Like, what are also ironically called Indians, but you know, like the First Nations. And, you know, like, you'd have people, of Indian background saying like, well, you know, like, we can make it in Canada. We don't go on welfare. We can do well. Like, well, why are these people, like, getting special privileges? And then not acknowledging, you know, like, the histories that are at work there, and also not acknowledging, shared struggles. Mm-hmm. So I mean, that's a basic kind of background. And in the story, I talk about like this very, I think, telling anecdote, which is about one of my cousins, where like when I was growing up, we all ate Kentucky Fried Chicken all the time. That was kind of, that was like that and McDonald's were a family staple. We were like an immigrant family,
right.
And so we would go on regular runs to KFC, and we were going into like a parking lot once, and we saw like a black family coming out, and my cousin said, "Boy, those black people sure love fried chicken."
In contrast to you guys,
like, you know, like. In contrast to us, exactly. Like we're eating fried, we're actually going to the same place. Like,
I think it's
a particular type of racism where it's not the racism of the sort of master and slave. It's the racism of the sibling rivalry. It's the racism of people who are, you know, I don't want to be seen to be the same as you, even though we might have some similarities.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And then how those things are exploited within the context of the conservative movement specifically. You actually mentioned that some of your relatives and community are very explicitly anti-racist. And I want to circle back to that at some point, because that's a very different history and linkage there that's really, I think, really important to mention when we have this conversation. So we will get to that. But let's look at Dinesh D'Souza, because you do a couple of things in looking at his biography and looking at his history that I think are really important, and I think which I want you to elaborate on. And number one, which I think really bears repeating, that he is almost like the kind of conservative intellectual equivalent in some ways of someone like Sarah Palin, in the sense that maybe at this point a lot of people would say, oh, well, you know, he doesn't represent the conservative movement. He's kind of on the fringe. We don't really like him anymore. He's not really – he doesn't represent us. This guy was highly respected within not only really the conservative movement, but really this is someone who wrote incredibly reactionary books that were reviewed by the New York Times, that were, you know, really thought worthy of public debate. And really, with the exception of this kind of juvenile – sort of hunt for retweets that he's devolved into, there's nothing really different on the substance. So that's one thing that's very important. The other thing is you talk specifically about his mentor at Dartmouth and this sort of line of colonial subject writing, basically, that he fits into. Now, that's a lot, but I think both of those themes are really important. I'd love you to get into both of them and how it illustrates the bigger picture you're getting at.
Sure, yeah. Well, I mean, right now, D'Souza is considered to be a clown, like not just by, you know, like liberals and leftists, but by, you know, like a lot of conservatives. But I think we have to actually step back and look at the history, because when he emerged in the early 1980s, he was like seen as like, you know, the future of conservatism. Right. He was like the next William F. Buckley, the next George Will, right? He was a grad, came out of Dartmouth, and he was an editor at the Dartmouth Review, which we'll go back to, but he started publishing at National Review. But by the late 1980s, he was like publishing, you know, not just there, but like he had a big cover story in the Atlantic Monthly on political correctness. He was writing in the New Republic. He was writing in the American Scholar. You know, like he was treated as someone, and he was like a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, which is, you know, supposedly a haven for like these great minds. And later he was at the Hoover Institute. So he was treated as a very serious kind of intellectual, and which is a bit odd, because I think like the sort of juvenile racism that we see now was always in his work, right? If you go back to the Dartmouth Review, the student paper that he edited, like one of the things he put in the paper was this like attack on affirmative action that was written in like Amos and Andy talk, like, you know, we sure is happy to be in Dartmouth. You know, I mean, that's like, so that's like right from the start. And another thing he
said. So maybe he really was the next William F. Buckley. No, I'm a cheap shot. Okay,
well,
go ahead.
You know, like, so he, and I think that one of the things about him that made him appealing was, and not just him, but like he was able to put more benign face on, sort of like reactionary racial ideas to say, like, well, this guy's against political correctness and he's like an immigrant from India, you know. This guy's against affirmative action and he thinks, like, you know, we should rescind the Civil Rights Act, which is, you know, what D'Souza advocated. But, you know, like, he's a more, like, visibly appealing figure for putting forth those ideas than someone like Charles Murray, who's, you know, whiter than cocaine and, you know, like burned a cross when he was a young man, right? Like, so the
youthful
so
excess.
I think that that's a big part of
right.
Yeah.
Right.
But I mean, to go back to his Dartmouth Review thing, one of the academic mentor at Dartmouth who helped create the Dartmouth Review, was created in his living room, is a fellow named Jeffrey Hart, who's was a National Review editor and is an English professor, and he was like a pretty reactionary guy. I mean, he's kind of changed politically over time, but in the context of the 1970s and 80s. I mean, there's two things I'll point out to. One is that he reviewed this novel called *The Camp of Saints* by a French writer Jean Rispal, and that's like an incredible novel. It's about like these sort of this flotilla of refugees that are floating into from India to France, and that are threatening French civilization. And the heroes in the novel are these like old guard French aristocrats who like shoot these immigrants, right? And the villains are all these like liberals who like want to allow like, you know, like massive refugees into France. And Hart reviewed this novel and, you know, like praised it to the stars. He compared it to like, you know, James Joyce, Stravinsky, D.H. Lawrence. And then what he wrote was that this novel brings readers to the surprising conclusion that killing a million or so starving refugees from India would be a supreme act of individual sanity and cultural health. And that Jean Rispal is to genocide what D.H. Lawrence is to sex.
Oh, my God. It's so obscene. And the novel sounds almost like, and maybe I'm reaching, but one of my favorite movies is the Buñuel, is The Discreet Charm of the Bourgeoisie. It sounds almost like The Discreet Charm of the Bourgeoisie mixed with like, you know, the platform of the National Front or something. It's just like this really grotesque hybrid of a kind of aristocratic indulgence, murder and racism. And this is what, and this guy was saying, go ahead.
Exactly. And then held up as a model, right?
Like,
It's kind of curious that Hart, and then Hart really took to D'Souza and thought, like, you know, he helped D'Souza when D'Souza was still an undergraduate to publish in National Review. And then Hart was always praising D'Souza to the I was just saying about Jeffrey Hart. I mean, it seems like a paradox that a guy who would, you know, celebrate an openly racist, genocidal novel against Indian refugees would, you know, become the mentor of a young man who's an immigrant from Mumbai, India. Mm-hmm. But actually, it's not so paradoxical because in the Rispal novel itself, and Hart points this out, there's actually like a good Indian. There's a very dark-skinned Indian who moves to France, assimilates to French culture, and, you know, is on the side of the people who want to keep the refugees out, right?
Right.
So there's this idea that, like, I term this as sort of like the ethnic sidekick, right?
Yep.
It's like, you know, the Lone Ranger has Tonto, the Green Hornet has Kato, Will Eisner's The Spirit had Ebony White, you know, like you always have like the white hero who has like the Gunga Din, right? It's Kipling's idea of Gunga Din, like, you know, like this is like the loyal servant who helped support the empire.
Right.
And, I mean, it's hard not to see like D'Souza as like, you know, fulfilling that kind of role because he basically, you know, supported everything that Jeffrey Hart did in the 70s and 80s, you know, became a very reactionary National Review conservative, but, you know, was able to put, as I said, like, the face to it that, makes it more like, palatable or less like obviously a defense of, you know, white privilege.
Right. And, so this is really important. And I want to get actually, cause you also talk about James Burnham, who's kind of the real ultimate guru of a lot of this. And there's even more to pick apart with this sort of like the, you know, colonial assimilation and the role in enforcing colonial values and of course, but I think that what you're pointing out that's so important about your piece is I think that there's a broad kind of recognition that those that would deny that there is white privilege or there is systemic racism or those that are pushing this far right agenda, obviously from a PR perspective, it is preferable to have, you know, black and brown faces.
Yeah.
To advance those policies. And I would also add that, you know, knowing some people who are involved in pretty conservative politics on that sort of very, you know, there are these different scales when we discuss racism, obviously, and what it sometimes gets really reduced to are like, you know, literally, are you a personally sort of hateful person of people from other backgrounds? And you know, they in fact are not. They might actually, you know, they might be in marriages to people who are outside of their ethnic group or anything or something like that. So in that sense, they probably feel more comfortable with that as well. But I think what you're pointing out is it's not just a desire for different faces, and it's not just a way of blanketing over those differences. It's a very, very specific role. It's the reaffirmation role. It's not even a conservative, like, you know, I believe in small government or whatever, but I still accept that racism is a very real thing, or I still am not entirely enrolled in this whole system or game or mythology that we live in. You have to really reaffirm it and rearticulate it. And, you know, it made me think, and I want you to touch on this too, that is a real – there's the racism that's targeted at Obama. But every time, you know, we talk about the, you know, this nonsense, this craziness about him being an anti-colonialist and all, as if somehow America – I mean, of course, our founding was anti-colonialist, obviously. A lot of people pointed that out. But that – every time Obama acknowledges, even in the softest terms, a flaw in America or Christianity or whatever, that is not only an innate problem, it's sort of doubly dangerous because he is not playing that role that basically educated members of the colonial subject populations better play.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I mean, I think that Obama, I mean, from my point of view, is a pretty centrist figure. But
totally.
He seems totally threatening to these these reactionaries, because even the slightest acknowledgement that, like, you know, there's like a problem is a threat to the system. And what you need is someone like D'Souza who will affirm the goodness of the system. And I mean, beyond the Obama stuff, like, D'Souza does, like, you know, go into, like, you know, well, just, you know, justifying the wars against the Native Indians, just, you know, like, saying, like, slavery was, like, you know, like, it helped the blacks because it gave them economic advantage, you know, and they were treated well because they were valued as property. And so he's, like providing exactly that justification. I think one way to think about this is in terms of, like, which audience are you addressing, right? Like, because I think that there is a genuine, like, you know, African-American conservatism that's very authentic, but because it comes from the black community and it's addressed to the black community. I mean, right. I'm talking about people like Booker T. Washington or even like Marcus Garvey, who can be seen as both radical and conservative.
Oh, but Louis Farrakhan, I think, is very much in that tradition.
Yeah, because it's an ideology of self-help, right?
Right.
It's like, you know, like the white man will never do anything for us. You know, like liberalism is a fraud. You know, we got to just like work on, be self-reliant and work for ourselves. And that's a genuine conservative strain in the black community, and there are parallels in among, like, you know, like Asians and other immigrant groups.
Right.
But that's all addressed internally to the community, right? Like, Farrakhan is talking to other black people. But if you take that same message and you're addressing it to a white audience, it becomes something very different. It becomes not self-help. It becomes a way of justifying the status quo. And I think that that's what troubles me about these, like, sort of black conservatives and Asian conservatives and non-white conservatives. Like, if they were just addressing their own community, that would be one thing. I mean, I sound like Ben Carson maybe shows the trajectory, right? Because he, I think, initially was coming out of that black conservative tradition of, you know, like, self-help. But then once it becomes But once you're addressing CPAC, right? Like once you're addressing a nearly all white Republican audience and saying blacks got to pull themselves up by their bootstraps, it becomes a very different message.
Right. It's a exactly. And you and yeah. and just to complete the thought on this role specifically, you talked. I think it was Burnham who talked about how, you know, some of the best fighters for the British Empire were Gurkhas, I believe. And,
yeah,
you know,
Gurkhas and right. Sikhs, which I have a very funny.
Do you have a Sikh background?
Yeah, I'm Sikh. Uh-huh. My family is Sikh. So right. that really resonated to me. Like, oh, yeah, I can become the ethnic sidekick.
Yeah.
And Burnham specifically said, like, yeah, the greatest moment was, like, when you have, like, these, you know, British officers leading, like, these, you know, black and brown troops. And they could accomplish great things. And he lamented, like, that, you know, like, we're, you know, this is the terrible thing about the decolonization. We're going to lose all these wonderful, like, you know, cannon fodder. So for me, the saddest thing about D'Souza is I like, you know, like even though it's been very lucrative, like he's made a, you know, he's become wealthy doing this stuff. But I mean, like, how humiliating is it to be Tonto? Like, how humiliating is it to be, like, you know, Cato, right? Like,
well, if you were like, Dinesh D'Souza, and if I was you, I would tweet that at him. That's a pretty provocative tweet. But before we wrap this up, I do want to touch on this other tradition because I think it's very important. And I think just as what I love about your perspective is you've really showed almost that someone like D'Souza, and that obviously he's just an example, there's many others, is almost the kind of, that's the public intellectual or, you know, pundit equivalent of those soldiers, of those colonialist subjects in the conservative mind. And that's just, it adds a lot to our understanding of this. But on the other hand, we know that there is these global connections and these alliances and these histories go in a different direction. And we know the kind of really deep connection. It wasn't just that, you know, Martin Luther King Jr. read, you know, Gandhi. He was really a student and a visitor to India, and the cross sections between those two cultures and movements are very, very close. I think closer than people realize. Malcolm X, you know, was assassinated. The anniversary of his assassination was this past weekend. Was not only a great leader that actually moved in between those leftist traditions and the very much the black conservative tradition. Really, by the time he was assassinated, was a global anti-colonialist, as well as, you know, and then, of course, the Islamic and Islamophobia debate is implicated by that. So, you know, what's this other tradition that we can draw on?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it has, like, really deep roots. And going back, even like well back into the 19th century you know, like abolitionists working with Irish rebel leaders, like, yeah. You know, like Frederick Douglass went to like Ireland and like, you know, saw a great commonality between the Irish struggle for independence and the struggle against slavery. And then I think the person who really articulated this best was W.E.B. Du Bois, you know, like a titanic intellectual in the early 20th century who said, you know, the color line is global, right? Like that there's a global color line and that's the problem of the 20th century. And Du Bois, in all his work, really saw commonality between, you know, the struggles for independence in Africa, in Asia, and the struggle for decolonization in America. And the two things, like, really went hand in hand, and in very complicated ways. I mean, I think one reason why the civil rights movement was able to take off in the 1950s was that the Eisenhower and the other Cold Warriors realized that, you know, like, if Africa becomes independent, like, you know, like, it's and Asia becomes independent, like, we can't have it'll look terrible to have Jim Crow here.
Those are votes at the UN.
Yeah, the votes in the UN, yeah. But also, like, you know, like, it's a huge propaganda victory for the
Definitely.
Soviet Union that
right.
they can point to, you know, like, that America is so racist and segregated. So the struggles have gone hand in hand, and this is the greatest irony because Dinesh D'Souza is a beneficiary of the civil rights movement in a very specific way, which is that prior to 1965, the American immigration was like hugely racist, had a quota system. You could, I mean, basically only allow like a couple of hundred people from India into America at a time, right? Mm-hmm. And the immigration system was favored towards like Northern Europeans, right? Not just like, you know, like Europeans in general. Like if you're Italian, you're out of luck. Like you have to be like, you know, like Swedish.
Real Europeans. We're not messing around here.
They're blonder than blonde, you know?
That's right.
And but I mean, that changed because of pressure from the civil rights movement. Like, just because as you were getting the Civil Rights Act, you had people like looking at the immigration system saying, you know, we can't have you know, like civil rights and have a racist immigration system. And the person who pushed that forward was Ted Kennedy. Yeah. So Dinesh D'Souza, I honestly don't think he would have been allowed to immigrate to America if it weren't for the civil rights movement.
So we really needed to rethink the civil rights movement.
That's right. I think that's the ultimate. I mean, it's the ultimate irony, and that it's exactly. I think that the way it's come is like. I mean, you still have a huge amount of hierarchy in America. You have a perceived hierarchy of races. And, you know, like African Americans are, you know, near the bottom of that ladder. And for someone like D'Souza, like, you know, like, well, I want to rise up, so I have to step on them to climb up that ladder, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, it's the dark side of upward mobility and assimilation. He's assimilated to the worst aspects of American society.
Well, that's no better place to leave it. I hope Rudy Giuliani hears this. He'll have an aneurysm. Jeet Hare, Canadian journalist and author of this recent piece in the New Republic called How to Make It in Conservative America If You're Not White. I guess it's either a critique or an instruction manual. I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It was great to talk to you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Okay.
Really great writer. Really admire his work a lot. I hadn't noticed him until a couple of months ago, and I've started looking at his stuff. Very, very smart guy.
Here's some news for you. Walmart has announced that they will be giving raises to their low-level hourly workers this year and continuing into the next year, at least. Walmart CEO Doug McMillon wrote that the company decided to give employees raises to $9 an hour this year. Wow.
How generous.
And $10 an hour next year. Wow.
Huh.
Wow. Because of corporate conscience, says Gawker, being very obviously sarcastic. This is Hamilton, Nolan, and Gawker. But now this is directly quoted from the Walmart CEO. We're always trying to do the right thing and build a stronger business, says Walmart CEO Doug McMillon. We frequently get it right, but sometimes we don't. And when we don't, we adjust.
Oh my God.
We take a step back, and it's clear to me that one of our highest priorities must be to invest more in our people this year. Now, Hamilton, Nolan, and Gawker wrote this great piece about how, you know, they're feeling pressure. And it's true. This is not an example of, you know, good for them. They've realized their wrongs or they want to make things better for their workers. No, this is not that at all. This is an organization that actively tries to keep their workers in poverty.
That's correct.
They are hardcore in trying to stop any notion that their workers even think about forming or joining some sort of workers' union. This is the same organization whose workers cost U.S. taxpayers $6.2 billion in public assistance. This includes food stamps, Medicaid, and subsidized housing because they pay them so little. And to give you an even further example of how much the Waltons, the family that owns the majority stake in Walmart, care about the people. The Walton Family Foundation is their nonprofit organization that gives to charities. It has around $2 billion in assets. To give you an example, Bill Gates, whose worth is $93 billion. I'm sorry, his worth is $59 billion compared to the entire Walton family, who is $93 billion. So as a whole, the family is worth more than Bill Gates.
Hard work.
Gates endowed to his foundation more than $33 billion, which is 57% of his wealth. That Walton family, $2 billion, just 2.4% of that family's wealth. To go even further, Bill Gates and Warren Buffett give 36.2% and 26.9% of their respective wealth to charitable causes. The Walton family gives 0.04% of their fortune to charitable causes. And I'd like to add that one of the major charities they give to is the museum owned by one of the Walton family.
Yes, which is in like the middle of Arkansas. It's like in the, it's like in some small, and supposedly it's amazing museum. And it has nothing to do with anything.
Hey, everyone has a hobby. You know, some people
everybody
go to the movies. Some people, you know, they knit, they play sports.
You know, she did that on court, top of putting 50% of her income into real
other
things.
People just
that
put, other people just put tens of million dollars into a museum in the middle of nowhere that they own. I mean, just... They're one of us, people. You know, they know how hard it is. So they want to be kind to the little people and give them a $9 an hour raise this year, maybe a $10 an hour raise next year. No, that's not what's going on. What's going on is that the protests and the movements to raise the wages in this country, specifically, there's been protests against Walmart. There are organizations specifically dedicated to picketing and fighting and working to make Walmart realize this is not going to stand. And along with that, the growth of the knowledge of what's going on with income inequality in this country. You know, this is a huge issue now. And what you're seeing is the Walton family and the CEO of Walmart and all the other Walmart executives realizing that if they don't try to nip this in the bud, at least little by little, give a little concession here. You know, $9, let's give that $9 an hour concession now. And, you know, maybe we won't get torn to shreds and lose our business completely when things real, when it really comes to roost, you know, because that's what's going to end up happening.
It's all PR.
They really are, you know, it's for the business. Let's not kid ourselves here.
And let's put heat on other places so they feel compelled to do the same thing. Should we go to the fun half?
Let's go right to the fun
half. Okay,
great.
Matt, you want to lead us through some membership pleading?
Sure. You could become a member of the Majority Report. And you support this show. Just you make this show exist, period. Both halves, the free half and the members only half. But by becoming a member, you get access to the members only half too. So you could do that by going to jointhemajorityreport.com or you can just go to majority.fm, click become a member. It's that easy.
It's less than
a cheap deli cup of coffee a day. You could also support this show by going to majorityreportkickback.com, and when you go there, you will be forwarded to Amazon, and you will notice no difference in prices, in selection of products, etc. The only difference is that when you hit the pay button, Amazon gives us a small percentage of what they receive for your purchase. You get your stuff from Amazon, you take some money from Amazon, and you give that money to us. It seems pretty like a win for us.
It's a win and a win for you. You get to
And speaking of wins, nothing more is a win. Then justcoffee.coop, that's justcoffee.coop, where you use coupon code majority. And when you use that coupon code, you get 10% off your order of fair trade coffee and chocolates. I mean, there's a Majority Report blend, which is delicious. There's also a Marin blend, which is
not delicious.
Well, it's also delicious because it's still coffee from Just Coffee. But
of course.
It's not as delicious.
They can't help but make it delicious.
It's psychologically less delicious because it's Marin. It's a Marin blend. No, but no. Everybody has their own tastes. So just get your coffee, get your chocolates, use coupon code
Majority.
Some
of those tastes are good and some of them are
exactly.
not good.
Subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/Sam Cedar. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/The Majority Report. Follow us on Twitter at @MajorityFM. We will see you.
Wait, and what is the number to call?
646-257-3920. That number is 646-257-3920. You could also IM us at
Majority. Yeah, there's no IMs so far, only one. So
IM us through the app.
IM us through the app.
App's free, majorityapp.com. Download it on your friends' phones. It's a great way to get people into the show. They can watch videos on there. They can watch listen to the live show and watch the live show. It's a great app, and it's free, 100%.
Great stuff happening in the fun half. We will see you there. Please join us.
Sam Cedar is back tomorrow.
An apple pie.